is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, hoop heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish home machine. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, everyone. This is Liz Kay, head girls basketball coach at Wakona High School in Dalton, Massachusetts, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com.
We have great facilities and we have a great fan base. We lead the league in attendance every year. And it has been easier for us to recruit kids away from here than it has kids near here. You look at this year, we started 3 kids from Illinois and 1 from Wisconsin. And so, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And we've been pretty successful doing that. And if we have to do that, we'll do that. But we'd much rather recruit local kids. And we're starting to make some inroads there.
Scott Nagy is entering his 6th season as the head men's basketball coach at Wright State University. A 3-time Horizon League Coach of the Year selection, Nagy won 20-plus games his first 4 seasons with the Raiders and tallied 18 wins in the shortened 2020-2021 campaign. In 2020, Nagy became the 61st NCAA head coach and the 28th at the Division I level to reach the 500-win mark and has won over 100 games during his tenure at Wright State. Prior to Wright State, Nagy spent 21 seasons at South Dakota State. During that time, he guided the school from Division II to Division I and compiled an overall record of 410 and 240. Nagy began his coaching career at the University of Illinois under Hall of Fame coach Lou Henson, where he got to coach alongside his dad Dick, who was a longtime assistant under Henson. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at HoopheadsPod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Pod Network for more great basketball content. Be ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Scott Nagy, head men's basketball coach at Wright State University.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel this afternoon, but I am pleased to be joined by Scott Nagy, the head men's basketball coach at Wright State University. Scott, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you on, get a chance to dig into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. A wide variety of experiences that we want to be able to touch on. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, my dad played for Lou Hent. Jack Hartman or Lou Henson first recruited him to Hardin-Simmons, and then he finished playing for Jack Hartman, who went on to Kansas State. Lou actually went to New Mexico State, where he went to a Final Four, and then Jack Hartman went to Kansas State. But Dad played for both really good coaches at Hardin-Simmons, and then he was a graduate assistant there. I was born in Abilene, and Abilene, Texas, where Hardin-Simmons is. And then he moved to Barton County Community College, which he was the very first coach that Barton County ever had in Great Bend, Kansas. And I think he was there 8 years. I think I moved there when I was 3, and he got fired when I was 11. So that was my first experience, real experience with coaching, is, you know, yep, just the hiring and firing. And so that, you know, that's kind of where it started for me, you know, in Great Bend, Kansas. I thought, you know, at that age, that those guys are the greatest basketball players ever. And so I, you know, my grade school years were there, and that's kind of where I started playing basketball. And all my heroes were junior college players, and you know, great guys. My dad was a tough coach, a very, you know, he couldn't survive in today's game. They wouldn't allow him to do and treat players the way he did back then. You know, in the early 70s, and so. But he was a very tough guy, very defensive minded. And so, you know, that's where I got my start. I played, you know, all the grade school basketball and things like that. But it was because my dad was a coach.
Did you get to get in the gym at the schools where your dad was to be able to play?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I got to do a lot of that and go shoot around at Barton County. And, you know, I can remember all kinds of things. You know, my dad went from Barton County to we got fired, and he was out for maybe a year. He was out selling cars and losing his mind and hating him. Then he got back into it at East Central Junior College in Union, Missouri, and he was there for a couple of years. So my 6th and 7th grade years, I was in Union, Missouri, and then Coach Henson was at the University of Illinois. And brought him over to the University of Illinois. And so my 8th grade through high school, I spent in Champaign, Illinois. And, you know, I think his position enabled me to be involved in basketball at levels probably some other people weren't. And so, I remember my first year in Champaign. And Illinois went to the NIT tournament, which seemed like the biggest thing in the world back then in 1979. And, you know, you think about it, if Illinois goes to the NIT tournament now, they want to get rid of the coach.
Right, it's a disaster.
Yeah, yep. But back then it was the biggest deal ever. They made songs about the team and, you know, and Eddie Johnson was on that team. You know, Eddie Johnson, who played in the NBA for several years, was a very good pro. But anyway, I remember we went to the Final Four, and which was in New York City, and I got to shoot around in Madison Square Garden, things like that, you know, that other kids normally wouldn't get to do. You know, I got to do because my dad was a coach in the Big Ten.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you realize how lucky you were, or was that just kind of that's the way your life was at the time?
Yeah, I didn't realize how fortunate I was. I, you know, just that was just a. My normal life at that point.
What was your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player? Does anything stand out, one particular moment or moments that you remember?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, my senior year, we had a very good team. You know, Illinois back then in the 80s only had two classes, A and AA, and we were in the largest class. So that would be, you know, with all the big city schools. And, you know, back then the Elite Eight was played in Champaign. You know, now it's played in Peoria. But you know, for us to be at Champaign Centennial High School there, a hometown, and we made it to the Elite Eight, and I think we beat, I think it was, it might have been Aurora. No, it was Joliet. It was a Joliet school. I can't even remember who we beat in the Super Sectional to go to the Elite Eight, and that was really a big deal. We had, you know, we were 26-4, and I had Roger McClendon on my team that was a McDonald's All-American. He actually played at Cincinnati, and we just had a really good high school basketball team. And that, you know, just being able to play in an Elite Eight, and, you know, we went to Elite Eight and got beat by Aurora West, and Kenny Battle was on that team, and so, you know, then I went on to play, and when I came back to Illinois as a graduate assistant, I got to actually coach Kenny Battle for a year, so that was interesting. But to be able to play in the Assembly Hall, in front of a bunch of people, in your hometown was really a great experience for me.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Being able to do it, like you said, in your hometown,
made it even more special.
Yeah, and only have two classes. I mean, you had to beat out a lot of teams to get to the Final Eight. Now, I think they have four classes now, but two classes, and we were in the big class, and so you had to beat some really good basketball teams to get there, and we had a good team.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, I think any high school player, you get an opportunity to play in your, state Final Eight or your state Final Four and get down, like, in the state of Ohio, obviously, to get to Columbus. And back when I was playing, I never was fortunate enough to make it down. But think about playing in St. John Arena and what that meant, all through the time in Ohio high school basketball. It's just, it's just a special opportunity that not everybody gets an opportunity to do, for sure. Talk about your decision to go to Delta State. What was your recruitment like?
Oh, I wouldn't say I was highly recruited. I was kind of a late bloomer. Yeah, I played a little bit as a sophomore. I started as a junior and was a major contributor. And then, our senior year, I've already talked about, and I was a major contributor then. But I was never a big scorer. I averaged 10 points a game as a senior. But I was a point guard. I thought like a point guard. I was a coach on the floor. Those kind of things. And, I would say the start of between my junior and senior year, people started looking at me a little bit, but they were, it wasn't Division I or, it was Division III schools and, things like that. And so I really didn't know where I was going, even all the way through my senior year. And, I was started to get some Division II recruiting. Quincy University in Quincy, Illinois, brought me in on a visit. And the one thing about Delta State, Ed Murphy was there, and Ed actually played. Ed was from Syracuse, New York. Now, that's where my dad was from. And Ed was a year or two older than my dad, and he ended up at Hardin-Simmons, and Ed was the reason that my dad went to Hardin-Simmons, because he told Coach Henson about my dad. Coach Henson, my dad was in Syracuse, New York, working on a milk truck. And Coach Henson called him up and offered him a scholarship. Never seen him play, but just went on the word of Ed Murphy.
There you go. Connections were everything, right?
Yeah. And so, dad accepts it and goes from Syracuse, New York with my mom. They're just newly married, and drive all the way down to Abilene, Texas. And, what a change for them. That was kind of the start. Coach Murphy and my dad had known each other in high school, and so he was at Delta State at the time, and so I went down there to visit and really liked it. I mean, it was, the South was a lot different for me. It was kind of a culture shock, but that's how I got down there, was those connections. My dad knowing Ed, and it turned out great. I loved Delta State. Just had a great experience.
What was your favorite college moment? Same question as I asked you about high school.
Well, my first 3 years, I played on incredibly good basketball teams. I mean, my second and third year down there, I played with an NBA player, Gerald Glass, who after his sophomore year, my junior year, he transferred to Ole Miss. And that's my first 2 years, Coach Murphy was there, and then he went to be the head coach at Ole Miss. And then he recruited Gerald, and Gerald stayed one more year and then transferred to Ole Miss and went and played at Ole Miss and then the NBA. But I played with, a couple CBA players, and I mean, we had really good basketball teams and played in three NCAA tournaments. My junior year, we played in the Division II Final Four. in Hartford, Connecticut. That was a great experience. I just played with some really good teams, won a lot of games there. And, you know, it was an unusual situation where I got every game that I ever played at Delta State, I started in and played in really my freshman year. I had a point guard that was actually from Cleveland, Ohio, Aaron Smith. And he was a lot better than me, but Coach Murphy was mad at him because he came back out of shape. And so I got to start. And Aaron played most of the minutes, but, you know, I got to start the whole year. And I was freshman of the year in the league. And I mean, honestly, I was an average college player. I wasn't a great college player, but I played with good players, and I was smart enough, you know, to throw it to the right people. And I was a good ball handler and a good leader. I was just an average scorer, you know. I wasn't that just wasn't my deal. But I took care of the ball and got it to the right people, and was fortunate enough to play with a bunch of really good players. But I would say playing in that Division II Final Four was pretty cool for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine that would be exciting. I think your story of, you know, trying to figure out and how to fit in, and when we think about just where we are in terms of the transfer portal and guys coming in and starting to drop down into the high school ranks and AAU and everything, about people jumping from one place to another, I think there's so much to be said for figuring it out. You go somewhere and you figure out what you got to do in order to be able to get on the floor and kind of fight through adversity. And sometimes we don't always see that, unfortunately, in today's game the way we used to. When did you know coaching was going to be in your future? Was that something that you knew from the time you were a kid just because of the influence of your dad, or was it more a case of you got done playing and then you looked around and said, I want to stay involved in the game. Let me check out coaching. Which one of those routes more describes your path to coaching?
It was more the second. And the reason I say that is because my dad never wanted me to go into coaching. He did everything he could do to talk me out of it. And I remember when I went to college, he's like, don't go into education, you know, go into business. He did everything to steer me away from the college, from any kind of coaching route. And so I didn't go into education, so obviously I couldn't coach in high school. And, you know, I probably would have been, he probably did me a favor there, because had I gone into education, I'd probably be a high school coach right now and loving that. But I didn't. I went into business, and I feel like everything I've ever learned, I'm not exactly sure if I've ever used it. And then, you know, I graduated.
I got a business degree too. So,
well, there's,
I've used it,
you know,
I've used it a little bit on the side, but right. I ended up going back to school for education.
But there's so many people in business that have been incredibly successful that never even went to college. So
for sure,
I'm not exactly sure how much I've used it. I think if you knew you were going to go into coaching, I've always told people this, that if you knew that's what you wanted to do, you'd be better off to go into counseling or psychology, because those are the two things that we really do. And so when I came out of there, my dad was still in Illinois, and that was in 1988 and 89, and so I went back, obviously, because my dad was there. I could go be the GA there at University of Illinois, be a graduate assistant, get my master's, and, you know, I looked to get my MBA, but that would have been a heck of a lot of work, and I just, honestly, I didn't like school that much, and so I got a master's in sports administration, which, you know, I don't want to say it was super easy, but it was pretty easy. And I remember I met my wife, she was an undergrad there at the time, and she couldn't believe some of the classes that I was taking to get my master's, but I got my master's from the University of Illinois, and it is actually in kinesiology, even though it was sport management, but it was under the kinesiology department. So I have a master's degree from the University of Illinois, but just, you know, being there and having my first shot at coaching, and of course it was a little unrealistic, because my first year there, you know, coaching the Flying Illini, I would say it probably is the best team that the University of Illinois has ever had, even though we didn't win the national championship. I mean, it was a freakishly athletic, great team made up of all Illinois kids, and just a lot of fun to coach, fun to watch, you know, running around dunking, and just one of the most athletic teams, if not the, that I've ever seen. And so it was a little unrealistic thinking, oh, well, this coaching stuff's pretty easy.
It's pretty easy. You just roll this ball out. These guys go to work.
Yeah, it was fun to go to practice every day just to watch these guys. They were, incredible players, and it was a lot of fun for sure.
What was something that was maybe surprising to you about coaching that you didn't realize during all your time as a player? I know obviously you had conversations going along with your dad and you got to see some of the things, but when you actually went and sat in on coaches' meetings and did some of the prep work and all the things that we know as coaches that we put the time in but players don't see, was there something that surprised you that you didn't realize coaches spend as much time doing as they actually did?
Yeah, probably not, just because, I watched my dad all those years and obviously at the University of Illinois, you have more personnel. I mean, he was doing it as a junior college coach. He was doing it almost all by himself. I can remember him coming home after games at night, and, he wasn't a highly successful junior college coach. But I can remember him coming home and staying up late at night and watching TV and sitting with our dog and watching the Three Stooges, anything that would cheer him up after a loss. I do think that most players, I probably have a greater appreciation of it because I saw my dad, but most players don't understand the amount of work that coaches put in beforehand, to prepare their teams and the practices, the amount of time we put in to just planning a practice, and all the things that go into that and how it works up to playing a game and then the preparation for a game and the scouting. And most of them don't understand that, and that's okay. I think as a coach, I don't need them to understand that, but I, the information I give them or my assistant coaches give them, I expect them to take and take very seriously because, I know how much work goes into it.
Yeah, absolutely. What's something that you were good at right off the bat as a coach? And then maybe what's something that was maybe not quite as natural for you that you've gotten better at over the years?
I was very fortunate. My first two jobs, okay, so I went from and even when I was at the University of Illinois, I was a little unsure whether or not I wanted to coach. I knew I was getting my master's. I looked at possibly even going into Camps Crusade for Christ. I mean, there were all kinds of things I was looking at because I knew my dad didn't want me to go into coaching. And so I think just subconsciously I was trying to do everything not to go into coaching, but it's what I knew. I knew basketball. It's kind of what I knew. And, so I got this job coming out of the University of Illinois at South Dakota State University as an assistant coach. And I mean, I didn't have a clue what I was doing, particularly on the recruiting. I'd never recruited before. And so that, that was a new experience for me. But I was just very fortunate to work for a couple guys that had certain strengths and they were opposite of each other. And so my first guy was Jim Thorson, and Jim Thorson was a good coach at South Dakota State University. I worked for him for 3 years. My first year I got there, we went to the Final Eight. And then, or maybe it was, I can't remember, it was the first year or second year, but we went to two NCAA tournaments. I mean, we had just a good basketball team. It was my third year. We went to we won 19 games, and so two NCAA tournaments, one Final Eight, 19 games, and my head coach got fired. Now, Coach Thorson was a tremendous teacher, and the X's and O's and the fundamentals and all those things, which are things that I still needed to learn. I knew enough about it, but I needed to learn how to teach it and how to put a practice together. Still things I do today with practice, now I put a practice together, are what he did. And so I learned a lot from him. Now, where he was not strong was the relationships with the players. He wasn't very close to them. He didn't have a good connection to them. And so that was kind of my job as the assistant coach was to create that connection. And I think that's probably, for most assistant coaaches, that's usually their job. A head coach has to make the tough decisions, be the heavy hammer, decide who plays, who doesn't, all those things. And so the assistant coaches are the ones that kind of have to cover up some of some of that stuff. And it's not always that way. Sometimes it's the assistant coaches that are heavy and the coaches, their buddies. I mean, but coach wasn't real close to the players, Coach Thorson. And so I had to work hard at that part of it. And, you know, I learned how to recruit. I we recruited some really good players. And, you know, South Dakota State was a top Division II school at the time. And Division II was different than it is now. I mean, there are fewer. And, you know, South Dakota State was such, you know, it had over 10,000 students, which for a Division II school was a large school. And so we had some things going for us other than the fact that we were way out in the middle of nowhere. But we, you know, we led the nation in attendance. I mean, we had some neat things going for us. I mean, South Dakota State was like what Ohio State is to the state of Ohio. I mean, we were the largest school and, you know, people were interested in what we were doing even when we were Division II. So, and then he got fired just because he and the AD, quite frankly, didn't get along. And I was 26. I tried to get the head job and went through the interview process and didn't get it. And so here I am for 3 years, have done a great job, really, as an assistant coach. I mean, we went to the Final Eight, went to NCAA tournament, recruited good players, and I'm out of a job. I mean, you talk about an eye-opener for me to just how much an assistant coach is connected to the head coach, whether the head coach leaves or gets fired, and you've done a great job and you're out of a job. And it frustrated me so much, I considered just even getting out of coaching right then, which I'm glad I didn't. But I was disillusioned for sure and thinking, man, I hear I've done a great job and I'm without a job. And on top of that, you know, in the middle of that, we find out my wife's pregnant with our first child. I mean, you know, my father-in-law thinks that his daughter's married a loser. And
that's right.
I mean, it was a mess for sure. And I got the assistant's job at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. And Jack Morgan Thaler was the coach there. And Jack had been the head coach at Drake. And, you know, Jack played down at Houston with some really, really good basketball teams. He played with Alvin Hayes and was really, you know, the interesting thing is Jack was almost the opposite of Coach Thorson. Jack was tremendous with relationships with the players. He would meet with his players once a week, and, you know, he was great at the motivational side of it, and probably not quite as strong on the X's and O's. And so, you know, I went from a coach that was, you know, strong in the X's and O's and the fundamentals and the teachings, but not great on the motivational and that side of it. And so I got to learn that side of it. And then when I worked for Jack, I kind of got to work the other side of it, the X's and O's, and, you know, be more of the fundamental coach and the teacher. And so I was very fortunate on both sides. You know, as a Division II coach, you're the only assistant and you get a lot of responsibility. And so I got to coach a lot, but I got to kind of do both sides of it and learn a lot, and that really helped me, you know, when I went back to South Dakota State as the head coach at 28 years old.
How did you, during those assistant stops, did you keep a notebook? Did you keep a journal? How did you kind of catalog the things that you were learning along the way in preparation for what you hoped was eventually going to be an opportunity to be a head coach?
Yeah, you know, I wish I was more organized than that. I'm not really organized in terms of writing things down and keeping notebooks, and I'm thankful over the years I've had assistants that are that have kept my stuff. But Coach Thorson was really good at that, and so I kind of had all his stuff with me. You know, when I went to SIUE, I mean, Coach Thorson was great at that stuff. And so I had that stuff. And but then, you know, when I finally became a head coach, I had assistant coaches that were better at that, at keeping that stuff. I mean, I would always have people ask me, hey, do you have this on paper or this drill? You know, and I mean, like, I had it in my mind. I didn't have it on paper, but some of my assistants had it. And so I would refer them to my assistants. I wasn't real, real good at keeping good notes.
What was the biggest adjustment when you went from being an assistant to being a head coach? Obviously, we could probably spend 2 or 3 hours talking about all the differences, but just stepping into that other chair for the first time, sliding over whatever the 18 inches like you always hear about, what was the biggest difference in your mind that you remember back when you took over a program for the first time?
A couple of things. One, I can remember being an assistant coach complaining to my head coach about this player, that player, because he wouldn't guard like he's supposed to be defending, and you know, he wouldn't give the effort on the defensive end like he gives in the offensive end, and still the head coach is playing him because he's a good offensive player.
Right, there you
and
go.
Then I remember being a head coach and thinking, you know what, I mean, you got to put players on the floor that can put the ball in the basket. And you know, so it's easy to be an assistant coach and complain about things. I remember that, and I remember just the different feeling and pressure that I felt. It wasn't even close from being a head coach, from being an assistant coach to going to a head coach, and the amount of pressure that I felt. You know, when I got the head job at South Dakota State, it was kind of a neat deal, because when I went back to South Dakota State, there were several players on the team that I had recruited as an assistant coach. And some of them were seniors and some of them were juniors. And so they were excited to have me back, obviously because I had built a good relationship with those guys and recruiting them and coaching them for a year. And so it was just kind of a neat reunion that we had with those players. And, you know, Brad Soderberg, who came out of the Dick Bennett system, was the head coach there for a couple of years. And then Brad went to be the assistant coach for Dick Bennett of Wisconsin. And so I went back. And, you know, there's just a big difference between the Dick Bennett system. Now, defensively, in terms of the way I think, there's almost no difference in terms of what Dick Bennett does and what we do. But offensively, there's a big difference. I give our guys a lot of freedom offensively. Like, my whole deal has been recruit good offensive players, because I think it's really hard to – I mean, you can help a kid be a better offensive player, but there are just people that have a God-given ability to play offense and put the ball in the basket that other guys don't have. But every player I've ever coached, I know I can make a great defender. I mean, that's the way I feel. And because I think that comes down to more heart and desire than it does ability, where I think sometimes offensively, it doesn't matter what kind of heart you have offensively. It matters more so, do I have the ability to do it? And so I've always tried to recruit good offensive players, guys that can handle it, pass it, shoot it. And then I just hammer home the defense, and I give them a lot of freedom offensively. Good offensive players, we turn them loose. And so most of the teams that I've ever coached, we've scored a lot of points. Like we put a lot of points up on the board. And so those players, when I went back to South Coast State, they were excited to see me because they knew I would free them up offensively. Brad felt like, in order for South Coast State to win National Championship Division II, that South Coast State can't recruit the athletes that some other people can, and so we've got to play slower. And, right. You know, and I'm thinking just the opposite. And so I turned our guys loose, and early on, we were putting up hundreds on people. I mean, we were really getting up and down the floor. We had a tremendous, maybe one of the best point guards I've ever had was that very first year, a kid I recruited, Jermaine Showers, out of Racine, Wisconsin. And he could just go. And he had the shackles on him for 2 years on the offensive end. I mean, you know, because Brad wanted him to always slow it down and Jermaine wanted to go. And so, I went in there and just kind of freed those guys up. We were picked. I remember we were picked to finish fifth in the league out of 10, and we blew the league out. We won the league. My first 3 years there, we won the league every year. I think we were 75-10 in 3 years. It was almost surreal. Honestly, I would look at my assistant coach, Matt Morgenthaler, who was Jack's son, and I would look at him and sometimes go, like, what is going on? I mean, how, you know, we were so young and so dumb and, you know, still learning how to even be a coach. And here I'm a head coach and we're just winning 3 straight league titles and everything just seems so easy. And I remember my dad saying, hey, you need to get out of there. You're not going to make any more friends than you have right now. but that first year, honestly, as a head coach, is probably the most fun I've ever had, because I got to go back and coach guys that I'd recruited as an assistant. And we just had a great relationship and they were excited to have me back. And we had a great team. We really did. We won the league and made it to the regionals of the finals and lost Fort Hays State, who had a great team. And then the following year, we went back to the regionals and beat Fort Hays State, went to the Final Eight. And, you know, I'm just a young guy. I still learn how to coach. But I got to coach a lot of guys. It was a unique situation where I got to coach guys that I had recruited as an assistant.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often, I'm sure. I can't think off the top of my head of too many experiences there. Somebody would be recruited by an assistant coach, then they're gone, and then they come back as the head coach. I don't think that happens very often. Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com. When you think about your offensive system, and even though you've taken the shackles off your team and you want them to be able to utilize their skills, how has your offensive system changed over the course of your head coaching career, just in terms of sort of the way the game has evolved around threes and pick and roll, which when you go back 25 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of teams running that type of style. More people were running the Bobby Knight, you know, motion offense. And even if you were getting up and down the floor, you still didn't have the volume of threes and the amount of, you know, ball screens that we have in the game today. So how would you describe how your offensive system and philosophy has changed over the years?
You know, I don't think it's changed a lot. I'm a very simple thinker. I really am. I look at statistics. I'm a very, everything I do is just works around numbers. Numbers are very easy for me. They're very easy for me to understand. And so statistics are very important to me. The one thing about the 3-point shot, you know, I mean, when it first came out, Rick Pitino, you know, had this system where, you know, if you shot 33% from three, that's like shooting 50% from two, effectively. And it's true. You know, if you cut out everything else and say, you know, if we shoot 33% from three, we're going to score exactly the same number amount of points as we do if we shoot 50% from two. And all that's great. I get that. And I think people fall in love with the 3-point shot, and Seth Curry's really changed that. But I think the big thing, in my opinion, that people are missing, and, you know, we've really stressed in our programs, and I think if you go back and you look statistically, you know, what we've done and how we've scored the amount of points that we do is the free throw line. And if you shoot a lot of threes, if that's your deal, then the one thing that's going to happen is you're not going to get to the free throw line. And if I, as a coach, could go to the free throw line every time down the floor, that's what I'd want to do. Because that's like shooting 70%. If your team shoots 70% from the free throw line, that's like shooting 70% from the floor.
Yep.
And, okay, so if we're taking a lot of threes, chances are we're not getting fouled. And so my whole philosophy was always designed around getting the ball to the rim. I've always had good post players, always have people we throw the ball into, even guards. We post our guards. We like people that can post and play with their back to the basket. We like people that can drive. And over the years, we've developed what we call the 10-foot zone. The TFZ is what we call it. You know, I got it off of TMZ, you know, the 10-mile zone. This is the 10-foot zone for us. And, you know, when I started looking at statistically, that's where all the fouls happen, in the 10-foot zone, the TFZ. And so offensively, that's where we want the ball. Whether it's off the break, we want to get it there and then kick it out. If we're in our half-court motion, we want to get there. Either we drive it there or we throw it there. And then any passes that come out of there, because, you know, the defense has collapsed, those are the 3-point shots we want to be able to take. I don't want to shoot 33% from three. I want to shoot 40% from three as a team. That's my goal. And I always tell our players, if you're not shooting 40% from three, then you need to shoot less of them, or you need to get better shots. One of the two, because I want that to be your goal. And as a team, we've had some teams that shoot over 40%. Now that's tremendous. But if you go back and look at most of our teams, most years we make more free throws than our opponents attempt. And when we're doing that, we're generally winning games. And that's how we score points. I always tell our players, you know, you look at the high scores. Say, take the NBA, okay? Take Jordan back when he played, LeBron now. And if they're averaging 30 points a game, they're not making 15 jump shots. They're making maybe 10 shots, and then they're shooting 10 free throws. That's how they're doing it. They are getting to the free throw line, and they're shooting a high percentage. And so that is a big goal of our teams. And then consequently, obviously, defensively, we're trying to do just the opposite. We don't want the ball in the 10-foot zone. We do everything we can do to keep it out of there. And we don't want to foul. We don't want to put people on the free throw line. And so, you know, everything we do is really designed around that. It's very simple. And, you know, we want to recruit good shooters, guys that can shoot it. And, you know, I might complain that they're, you know, you're shooting too many threes or this, that, the other. In a game or in practice, I might say that's a bad shot. But I always tell them, you know, because I meet with my players a lot. And so a good shooter, you know, my instructions to him is when you're open, you better shoot it. I want a confident player that's not worried about what I think all the time, that won't look over at the bench and go, I don't need one guy jumping up and shooting the ball thinking, I wonder if coach wants me shooting this shot. That's a recipe for disaster. I want you shooting that ball because you want to shoot it and you know you're a great shooter. And so when I sit here in my office and I tell you when you're open, you better shoot it, listen to that. When we get out on the floor, on a practice floor in a game, and I get mad at you for this shot or that shot, I need that to go in one ear and out the other. You got to be tougher than that. You can't be worried about me all the time. Listen to what I'm saying when I'm in my sane mind in my office, and don't listen to what I'm saying all the time when I'm out of my mind in practice or in a game. And so, you know, our players have always played with a lot of freedom offensively, which, I want them to. I mean, that's one of the things we want our guys doing is playing freely. I've always told them this, freedom is earned. It's not like we're all just free and we can do whatever we want to do no matter what. That's not how it works. You earn the freedom by showing us in practice and by showing us statistically how good a shooter you are, because we keep stats in practice. And like we keep rebounds and we keep turnovers and we keep shooting percentages. And, you know, if you're shooting 30% from three, then you better be shooting less of them, or you better start getting better ones, or you know, you're just not going to have that freedom that we want you to have. And so, you know, that freedom's earned. But when you've earned that freedom, I need you to play with it. And I want you to be a confident player.
How do you instill that, the mentality to have your guys get into the rim, into that TFZ? Because I'm thinking, you know, there obviously are some players that just have the knack for getting there. So the part of that is probably just recruiting, looking for that type of player. But I'm guessing day in, day out in your practice setting that you're constantly preaching to them, hey, we got to get the ball into this zone. And then that's when we attack out for three. So what do you do? Do you chart the number of times guys get into the 10-foot zone? Is it just something that you're constantly talking about, discussing, emphasizing? How do you go about teaching that mentality of, hey, we got to get to the rim?
I would say the best way, you know, we've done it over the years, what we've developed is a scoring system in practice. And it revolves around a defensive scoring system, but it also... for us, we're a motion team. And so, my mental energy, quite frankly, goes mostly to defense. I mean, that's when I watch our teams play, I'm watching the team that's on defense most of the time, not the team that's on offense. But we have a scoring system in practice that we've developed, and it just rewards that kind of stuff. And so when you're doing it day after day after day after day, it just becomes a habit. It becomes a habit. We reward offensive rebounding. We reward, 10-foot zone shots over a 17-foot jump shot. If you score in the 10-foot zone, you make it three, they count the same for us. And so, you know, our guys understand that if you foul, it's, you know, we subtract a point. If you turn the ball over, you lose 2 points. Because the defense gets a point and you lose a point. And so we just kind of have a scoring system in practice that has really benefited us and just penalizes the things we don't like turnovers, and it rewards the things that we love, like offensive rebounding. You know, so we give 2 points for an offensive rebound. Well, if I'm on defense, I better not give up an offensive rebound. What do I need to do? I bet when a shot goes up, I better block out, or they're going to get 2 points. And so, you know, all the things we're trying to get done. I mean, we've always been a great rebounding team. This year, we average in league over 10 rebounds better a game than our opponents. We're one of the top rebounding teams in the country. I honestly give a lot of credit to that scoring system that we have in practice.
Do you guys, so I'm assuming that you're charting that scoring system, you're charting that live while practice is going on, right?
Yeah, like almost anything that we do, we're keeping score by that scoring system. And, you know, so, there's consequences for not winning in our practices. I mean, we want it to be competitive. And when I say that, my wife always told me that, you know, for every negative thing you say, you got to say 7 positive things. And, you know, I said, I don't know if I have time for that.
Do you get to that ratio?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I probably get closer than most players think, you know, because as humans, we remember the negative things that are said to us and we don't remember the positive. But I think if you went through a practice, you'd hear me tell a kid, good job, good job, good job. And then the one time I get after him, that's what he remembers. So I've learned to phrase things differently. So instead of the losers have to run, the phrase is winners don't have to run, you know, things like that. And we get exactly the same thing, but you say it in a positive manner instead of a negative manner. And so, you know, I'll say, we're going to do this. Winners don't have to run a 5 and 30, you know, five lengths of the floor in 30 seconds. And so, you know, just learn how to say things positively instead of negatively, which doesn't come naturally for me because I tend to think negatively.
I think a lot of people, when you talk about just that particular aspect of coaching, and I think back to the beginning of our conversation with talking about your dad and how you said, you know, he couldn't coach in today's era. How do you feel like that your style of coaching has changed over the years in terms of interaction with players and building relationships and that kind of, you know, again, when you think back 25, 30 years ago, there was much more of that separation of the coach and the players. And, you know, the coach was up here and you do things because the coach said, versus now, I think there's much more of a, you're building that relationship. You're asking the players what they see. You're trying to give them the why of what you're doing. So how has that impacted what you do day to day? And how do you think that's changed the way you coach in terms of your interaction with players?
It's definitely changed. I think part of it just becoming a parent. And, you know, learning that I can't parent like my dad. I don't get to just say, do this because I said so, because that doesn't necessarily get the reason why across to my son or my daughter, you know, and I want them to know the reason why. And so, but I also know the difference between why should I do it and why, you know, what is the reason we're doing this? I mean, there's a big difference in terms of the attitude of asking why. You know, sometimes it's like, I don't want to do what you're saying. And the other time is, you know, what really, why are we doing this? And I do think that's important. Now, you know, when I was a younger coach, it was amazing. I think back to how hard I was on those teams and the things I said to them in the film sessions and how sarcastic and I was brutal. I really was. I was very hard on them. And quite honestly, it wasn't fair. Some of the stuff I did. Now, I knew because we were winning, you know, we were winning at such an unbelievable clip. You know, those, like say those first 3 years, 75 and 10, I mean, I could say almost anything. They were getting their reward because everybody else outside of the program was telling them how great they were. And so they were getting their reward. But I'll tell you, when I went through that stretch, when we made that transition at South Dakota State from Division II to Division I, and we had about a 5-year stretch there where we were not very good. And we had a hard time keeping players, and I had to change. I watched kids get their tails handed to them, and I couldn't coach them like I coached kids that were, you know, 25 and 3. These kids were, you know, 6 and 22, and I couldn't be the same. I couldn't coach the same way because they were getting pounded and they were beat down, and I couldn't do that to them. And so that's really where, and I'm thankful for those days because I had to learn how to coach, you know, but before I just had better players than you and we just beat the crap out of you. and then when you had better players than me, we went D2 to D1, everybody had better players than us. I had to learn how to coach. And so those were incredibly beneficial days to me, a blessing when I look back on it compared to just, you know, I was so used to winning all the time, everything I did. And I went through this process of not being able to win. And it really made me take a look at what I was doing, kind of man I was, what was really important to me. Was it just about winning and people seeing me as a winner? Because I feel like that's where I was at that point. And all of a sudden I wasn't a winner and I felt terrible about myself. And yet I'm probably doing the best coaching job I've ever done and nobody even notices because we're getting our tails handed to us. And so that was a big process in my life, and a changing point for me to learn how to coach kids better, still get the same thing out of them without berating them and beating them down and saying things that don't need to be said. You know, asking for forgiveness where I never used to do that. I used to just, you know, I mean, I would just go right through people. And so, you know, I would say humility was a great thing for me. It helped me be a better coach, understand the players better, give them more grace, which is what I needed too. And so I'm thankful for those years. And you know, some of it's cultural change too. Kids today just can't handle what they, and I don't care what anybody says, I know that's the case. I've been coaching 26 years. 25 years ago, they could handle more than they can handle now in terms of what I say to them.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
You know, their kids are more entitled. They particularly the really good ones, have had everybody kissing their tails and telling them how great they are. And they've really not been, people haven't been honest with them about the things they need to change and their attitudes. And so, you know, kids cannot handle as much the criticism today like they could 25 years ago.
I think that introspection that you just shared, thinking about yourself and how you grow as a coach and just how you have to evolve with the times and being aware of it, it's something that I think everybody goes through, but I think it's something that's really, as you said, it's difficult. It's not easy to look in the mirror and say to yourself, especially like you said, when you're winning, you know, that covers over a lot of maybe ills that are going on behind the scenes, things that, you know, you might think about changing if you weren't winning, which obviously you had that stretch as you transitioned from D2 to D1. I want to be respectful of your time here, Scott, and ask you one final two-part question before we wrap up. When you think about the next year or two looking ahead, and this is obviously hoping that we're going to get back to normalcy with the pandemic and that things are going to be the way we all remember them at some point here, what's your biggest challenge looking forward? And then number two, when you wake up every morning and you go into your job and you get into the office there at Wright State, what's the biggest joy that you get from what you do every single day?
Well, I would say the biggest challenge, and we've taken this head on at Wright State, you know, in the state of Ohio, there's 13 Division I schools. And I think when we got here, just about any young man would have almost gone to any Division I school over Wright State. You know, we sit in Dayton, Ohio, and within an hour of us, we have 5 Division I schools, Cincinnati and Xavier and Miami and Dayton and Ohio State, that almost any kid would much rather go play than Wright State. And so one of the biggest challenges, and we're still working to get over it, is recruiting locally. And, you know, getting people to look at Wright State differently. And, you know, we're battling a generational thing here. It takes time, but winning is the only thing that'll change it. It just is. I mean, if you don't win, it's not going to change it. And we've won pretty consistently here for 5 years, and it's still a battle. But we're making inroads, and we know we're going to stick with it and start getting more local kids, which is what we want to do. You know, right? I mean, we have great facilities, and we have a great fan base. We lead the league in attendance every year. And it has been easier for us to recruit kids away from here than it has kids near here. You know, you look at this year, we started 3 kids from Illinois and 1 from Wisconsin. And so, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And we've been pretty successful doing that. And if we have to do that, we'll do that. But we'd much rather recruit local kids. And we're starting to make some inroads there. Our 2 freshmen that will come in this year are both within an hour. And so, you know, we're happy about that. And so that, honestly, that's the biggest challenge for us, is just that recruiting piece, particularly in Ohio. And then what was the second part of your question?
Your greatest joy.
I would say just the players. I constantly have to remind myself, because sometimes the pressure just takes away the joy. It's just like, you know, the expectations. And I've gotten used to the expectations, and I'm thankful for that, you know, that I've been involved in winning programs and people expect us to win, and that's a good thing. I would rather have that than people expect you to lose. But it can be draining. It really can. And, you know, you get to the point where you've won and you've won and you've won, and people just think, well, that's just the way it's going to be all the time, and it's going to be easy. And it's not easy. It's never easy. So I have to deal with that pressure, and it can steal my joy. But the players, you know, God constantly reminds me to pursue these guys and love on them, and, you know, that they are the reason why I'm doing this, not the wins, not my reputation, not anything about me. You know, when I make it about me, I'm a terrible coach. And I get uptight, and I make everybody else uptight, and we don't play well. And when I make it about the kids, I relax, and we play well. It is a constant battle, and I don't know if it'll ever change as long as I coach. I'm thankful I've got a great wife that can help me with that and help me see it when I do get that way. But I've just been very fortunate, honestly. I mean, you know, I have a lot of wins attributed to me, and I haven't made one basket. I haven't put the ball in the basket one time. I've been very fortunate and been smart enough to hire good assistants and have coached a lot of great players. And that's how you win. It just is as a head coach. I always say this. I'm a really good coach when I have good players, and I'm not a very good coach when I don't. And that is true. It just is. And so most of the credit should go to the players and the coaches that got them here. And, you know, I'm super thankful for my AD. I've got a great AD, Bob Grant, who just frees me up and lets me do what I do and is thankful that I'm here. And so I'm in a great spot, and mostly just, you know, my players are a great joy to me.
That's well said. Before we wrap up, if you wouldn't mind sharing how people can reach out to you after they listen to the podcast, whether you just want to share the Wright State basketball website, you want to share a Twitter account, social media, anything. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, you can just go. I mean, you can go to WSURaiders.com or whatever. You can find our basketball site. I mean, you could find it probably quicker than I could find it. I'm not much of a tech guy. I'm on Twitter at Coach Nagy. But, I mean, I don't hardly post anything, and I hardly ever look at it. I've learned to just get off social media because most of it serves to discourage than it does to encourage. And, you know, quite frankly, we're all not nearly as important as we think we are. And so I've kind of gotten off of that. I'm not much of a social media guy. I keep it pretty tight in terms of how I get my information. You know, I get it from my assistant coaches. And then other than that, I don't really search for Wright State men's basketball and anything else. In that way, I don't get discouraged when people are critical or whatever. And so I've learned to do that. And you can find my email on that Wright State website. It's pretty simple. It's scott.nagy@wright.edu. And you can email me. And if you wanted something from me, I'd have my assistant send it because they have all of it. I'm a pretty basic guy, that's for sure.
Keep your circle tight, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'll tell you a quick story. At Coach Nagy, right, is my Twitter, and the Bears coach is Matt Nagy, same spelling. And every time the Bears play, every Sunday in the fall, you can't believe the amount of people firing at me on Twitter about how bad the Bears are.
You know? You're gonna be picking the Bears in the next quarter, but you better hope Justin Fields is good. Maybe you'll start getting some positive.
Yeah, I know.
You'll
maybe that'll help. But I generally don't get anything positive. I only get the negative, and that's why I'm just better off to stay off Twitter.
That's good stuff. Well, Scott, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule today to jump on with us here. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.